Okay, so welcome to the month five investor briefing that covers the trading period, funnily enough, from the 1st of May to the 31st of May. As the briefing document explains, exchange traded receivables are leases, monetary obligations, or bills issued under contract for assets, goods, and services supplied to investment quality companies, or indeed credit insured invoices from the investment grade or IG insurers. So what this means is that an ETR is evidence of a debt owing from one company to another, and typically these tend to be large companies or banks that are household names, and they owe money to their smaller micro to medium sized suppliers, which we call originators, because they originate the debt obligation transactions that creates the ETR that ultimately get traded on the exchange. So the ETR, as you know, is evidence of the large company's liability to pay the smaller one, and credit exchange by these at a nominal discount to their face value. By doing that, when the ETR is settled or paid in full, the difference between the face value that is settled and the discounted price that it was purchased at creates a margin. And that's the margin that creates the yield or return for your investors. So credit exchange or the other companies in the credit group provide other types of credit facilities to other types of transactions, such as trade finance, asset finance, and others. And essentially, they all work the same way, that the traded ETR is a business transaction. The exchange provides liquidity, and it's paid a commission for doing so, much in the same way as a bank charges interest. When preparing for this briefing, there was multiple instances where I had to double check May's figures against April's, because there were many instances where numbers were static or appeared to be static, meaning most of the main figures like the active RSA, the allocation figures, and others remain constant, whilst at the same time, the value of trade increased by more than 40% and volumes increased by 6%. So that's pretty impressive stuff, if I must say so myself. We seem to be steadily increasing trade whilst maintaining a solid underlying basis, or the solid underlying figures. And that this means that we appear to be getting more efficient at how we use our funds, and maintaining the underlying figures solidly, and thereby being more efficient in doing so. So a good way to start this month's briefing, where, as the document states, at the end of May, Credit Exchange held active RSA of 70.47 million. And this was a repeat of April's figures. I might point out that I mispronounced or I misannounced 77.5 million in last month's briefing. The number should have been 70.5 million, and this month it's 70.47. So very little in the difference. So it's this month's figure is a repeat of April's figure. As you know, RSA stands for Revolving Sale Agreement, and a revolving sale agreement is a document, a contract between the micro to medium sized originator and credit exchange. So the revolving sale agreement is a commitment by the originator to sell a certain value of ETR to the exchange in any given period. And typically this is for 1 year. So the example I've been using of late is an originator needs a trade credit facility of 1 million in order to run their business. They come to one of the companies in the credit group, much like they would a bank. They apply for that credit facility of 1 million on a revolving basis of, let's say, every 60 days. So that means that every 60 days, they're going to sell us 1 million worth of ETR according to the revolving sale agreement. Therefore, over the course of a year, that will be 6 million worth of ETR over that 12 months. So it's this commitment to sell 6 million of ETR annually to credit exchange that is documented in the RSA with the credit group. Similarly, if we were looking at a leasing transaction where the originator wanted to buy an asset for, let's say, 5 million over 5 years. This would result in total payments over 60 months of approximately 6 million, meaning that each month for 60 months, the originator would pay credit 10,000 each month for those 60 months. Each one of these payments is an ETR, and collectively the total 6 million is part of the active revolving sale agreements, or RSAs, we report on at these briefings each month. Moving on to the number of 70.47. I've already pointed out that was mispronounced or misannounced last month. It actually should have been 70.47, and remains constant in May. So these active RSA contracts continue to remain short as trading patterns and the speed of settlement continued to be short. In other words, the cash to cash life cycle is shortening because of our continued and ever increasing trade and shipping and or freight finance that we're providing. Trade finance in its purest form, meaning that we're supporting mining related projects, commodity trades, and shipping related transactions, and that it's a core competency and a principal activity on the trade desk as we speak. More by coincidence than design, there's a solid link between what happens in mining and how shipping have become a core competence in the delivery of what we do, because all mining materials, or 95% of all mining materials, are delivered to the customers, funnily enough, by ships. regarding mining, last week was unusual in that both Sharon Lynch, who is our treasury manager, both she and I attended the Hillhead exhibition in Buxton. This was unusual for a number of reasons, most notably that Sharon would not usually be requested to visit customers in far-flung locations simply because her responsibilities typically demand her presence closer to home, meaning in the head office in Dublin. But for this particular originator, both Sharon and I attended because Credit is a strong supporter of this business that provides large plant machinery, professional services, and indeed project management and personnel to some of the largest quarry pits throughout England. And the large pits that this originator works in but belong to some of the world's largest infrastructure companies, groups like Cemex, CRH, who own Tarmac, and others like Lafarge and so on. So you'll see several of these names under the 10 largest investable holdings in the center of this month's briefing. And anyway, going back to the Hillhead exhibition, it's the Detroit Motor Show for mining and quarrying, or what is called the mineral processing industry. And this is one of the largest fairs of its type in the world, beaten only by another exhibition that occurs in Germany every 2 years and another one that's in Las Vegas every 4 years. Anyhow, while attending this fair, a number of points came to light. For example, almost 80% of the exhibitors were from Northern Ireland. And this is an industry where the UK consumes 120 million tons of aggregates annually. If Dublin is the world's capital for airplane leasing, then Northern Ireland would appear to be the world's capital for mineral processing equipment. Then there was various conversations that were had with industry veterans where the common thread was inflation, depression, and how Ireland, the UK, and the EU were going to manage the way through the tough times ahead. All agreed that any country that wants to counter a reduction in GDP, the simplest solution is for governments to spend funds on infrastructure projects. The UK is already doing this, but as you'll hear later in this briefing, there are few, if any, infrastructure projects, approved in Ireland. And this is in a country where there appears to be a dire housing shortage. The Rainbow government knows the issue, and yet all we hear is commentary confirming what everyone knows, but no visible actual action to solve the issue. If we do hit a recession, we'll be slow to react in Ireland, and the impact will be amplified by the lack of decisive action by the government in Kildare Street. In stark contrast, if you look at Ireland and its next door neighbour, it's potentially a little bit shocking, if not annoying. What we're doing at Credit isn't complicated. We're not economists or sophisticated investors backed by large research analysts, because at our size, we don't need to be. Common sense combined with careful consideration of what's in the business media has proven to be a sound basis for ensuring we are present in relevant markets so that we can meet the demand for safe yields over a short to medium term. We don't have the knowledge, the Department of Economics and the financial advisors that the government does. But if there is going to be a recession, whatever shape it takes, should we not be investing in infrastructure? And more is the point, should we not be investing in housing? Anyway, going back to the next figure in the briefing, there was 62.96 million of investors' funds, excuse me, fully allocated. As you know, this means that we had just over 62.96 million of investors' funds in the market. Add the 70.5 million of RSA or revolving sale agreements that represent future orders that we have on our books that are not yet filled. This amounts to over 130 million in trade that we have on our books for May, and this is a stable repetition of April's number. For 2022 and overall, this figure has continued to rise each month and shows a strong and stable growth as we put more money into the market. Moving to investor redemptions, withdrawals dropped by more than 50% to Euro 1.51 million and confirms that what we now have in terms of a new market cycle and pattern where there are significant peaks and then troughs. So prior month was 3.5 million money going out. This month, it's dropped by more than 50% to 1.51 million. Overall, investors' money in versus money out is still increasing marginally. So we're keeping an eye on that pattern. It's been in evidence since the end of last year. And seems to be, as I say, a new pattern in how investors' funds are moving in and out. So on the basis that we are still looking to meet the growth of our business in the increasing revolving sale agreements that we're signing, we've sped up our plans for raising additional debt to support our expansion in those markets that we've chosen to focus on. For the last 2 months, I've mentioned about inflation and that it looks even more likely, albeit that we all hope it doesn't happen, that we're going to head into a recession. But as we say in Credit, hope is not a strategy. In reading a recent article by Patrick Jenkins of the Financial Times, his comments piqued my interest when he started talking about the bond market, and more specifically, the Italian bond market. Government bonds are typically viewed by investors as a safe haven, a place to put cash for a rainy day, let's say. But Jenkins's article would cause one to pause for thought at what's happening at the moment in the sunny south of Europe and its potential impact on the EU economy as a whole. The ECB recently met with the Italian Central Bank in Milan to discuss with the Italian government the 10-year bond, which is currently yielding over 4%. The fear has long been held that high bond yields and rising inflation rates are a toxic combination, and Italy is being touted by analysts as the worst of its kind in the Eurozone. Any country with an ultra-loose monetary policy for the past 10 years that was seemingly not reined in by the ECB will find it very painful to normalize interest rates whilst at the same time trying to unwind their quantitative easing and also trying to curb the EU's rapidly rising inflation. Three tasks that would challenge the best of economic brains in a single economy, but how will the ECB handle it? Unlike what Jenkins calls the doom loop from 2008, where lenders and governments alike weakened each other via banks' large portfolios of Italian sovereign debt, this time round, the Italian banks are better capitalized and have stronger reserves. Sounds good, I would hear you say, but not so. These same banks have used the cheap ECB money they've been getting for the past half decade or more to buy the high-yield Italian government 10-year bond, effectively at zero cost, and apparently with only upside gains. As we all know, there's no such investment market ever where there's no downside. There's always a risk somewhere that someone hasn't considered, and yet en masse, banks and investors in Italy have followed each other into these seemingly no-lose investment opportunities. And Jenkin warns that although in theory Italian banks should be enjoying higher yield on these and their other domestic loan books, that's not the case because they're now faced with the rising cost of that credit where every time the ECB introduced another interest hike, this is going to be applied to the same credit that they used to buy the bonds in the first place. So this is an important transaction event that starts to put some real meat on the bones of the real toxic risk combination I just mentioned. Jenkins puts this into practical terms when he looks at how currently the Italian bank's bad debt to loan ratio is at an all-time low. But according to Mediobanco analysts, this low bad debt ratio is soon expected to return to the historic average default rate. And when this happens, it could wipe out 20% of most Italian banks' earnings. And then there's the exposure to the Russian and Ukrainian bond market, where as a result of the war and other market factors, Italy's two largest banks, Intesa and UniCredit, have lost 30% of their value since the invasion began back in February. The question is whether we're looking at some trigger event, like, for example, an outright and wide-scale Russian bond default scenario, like back in 99. In April of this year, Russia failed to make an interest payment and delayed it to May. There was another one earlier this month, and according to Reuters, Reuters headline, teetering on default, Russia misses 1.9 million payments. So this is a real indicator that Russia might do what it's done before under Yeltsin's reign. If so, how can the ECB prop the Italian economy whilst at the same time raising interest rates for the rest of the EU? The answer is it can't, because it's kind of in its name, i.e. that it's central. Whatever the ECB does across Europe, it does in Italy too. So the meeting with Draghi, who's the Italian president at the moment, in Milan earlier this month was significant. It seems to indicate whilst he's in power, things will remain stable, although to me it looks like to many spinning plates. But maybe, just maybe, Draghi and the ECB can keep them spinning. But what about Draghi's term that ends next year? Will there be a sell-off ahead of his departure? And will this happen towards the end of this year? Then there's the real threat of a Russian default, which yesterday evening on the news they were talking about this potential default. Is that going to break the first spinning plate and then cause a domino effect? Or is there another seemingly unrelated crisis that will spark the flame? Only time will tell, but what is happening in Italy and what is wavering on the brink should be a serious concern to anyone making investments. You might ask, why is Italy so important or even relevant to Ireland at all? Or indeed, why does the wider EU market care about the Italians? Well, what most people don't know is that Italy's bond market is the third largest in the world. A full-blown debt crisis in Italy would be cataclysmic, not only on a EU basis, but on a global scale. So sobering thought when considering any form of government bond risk thinking that it's some form of safe haven. And remember the joke back in 2009 about the AIB customer that puts his ATM card into the machine to withdraw money, only to see the message insufficient funds. And his first thought was, is that you or is it me? At the same time, when the AIB was all but bankrupt, they were still paying their suppliers, their electricity, their milk bill, and so on, because banks, like economies, must pay for essential supplies and they have to pay their utility and food bills. It is these essential supplies that credit funds, and it is these essential supplies that have and will continue to ensure your investors are not only safe, but stable and making an unwavering and solid return. So please remember that inflation is good for finance and for the provision of finance, and that's essentially what we do. So as stated last month, so long as we take sectoral views, certainly for 2022 and 2023, our overall outlook should remain positive. And as most of our trades are outside of Ireland and even the UK, we have the latitude to be very selective in what we do and where we do it. Last month, at the end of the briefing, I asked Ruby and Andrew to have a look at a specific and important market for us. So let's have a quick look and see what they found out a little later in the briefing. If Italy and or Russia trigger a sharp economic downturn, and we head into what I believe will be a medium or potentially long recession of several years, all of your investors will most probably rush to cash and cash equivalents, and hopefully they'll consider credit when doing so. Moving off that subject, moving to the Baltic Index, which is the index against which most shipping contracts are linked. The index has had a turbulent first few months in the earlier part of this year, hitting a low of 1,300 in January, before getting to an overall recovery that spiked and then remained flat in April. And this spiking has eased off further in May, dropping back down to 2,300. Last month, they said it's unlikely we'll see the volatility and record-breaking levels like the 3 and even 5,000 in the Baltic during last year. But it seems I might be a little bit wrong. In fact, this is starting to look like a repeat of 2004. But like I said earlier, there's a lot of different factors in this market, so it's very hard to make any form of reliable predictions right now, today. The war in the Ukraine, like inflation, and the threat of recession, all coming together, would seem to confirm my earlier points, as does the FFA market, that is ignoring most economic indicators and confirms the split between poor performing and strong performing sectors, because the FFA market is still continuing upwards, albeit slightly dropping before accelerating again. So the Panamax 4TC FFA rates were at 20,000 in January, and since March they've moved and remaining fairly stable all the way up to $27,000 per day. However, the price gains of the past 3 months have eased back to January's levels of 20,000. At these levels, meaning even at 20,000, the originators still require the finance to move their charters and their vessels and pay bunkers and so on. And this still remains, it looks medium to good in terms of the year for credit in that particular shipping market. Looking further out to the 12 month rate at the end of 2022, the rates remain stable, although there is a significant drop in the mid part of 2023, but a bit too early to read anything into that now. Quickly looking at the market research from Seaborn, from their weekly shipping market research reports, they summarize important events that will impact markets. And there's a stark contrast in the four headlines where it notes Biden in the US pledges $2.1 billion to fix the supply chain issues, particularly that of for the supply of food. At the same time, India has issued two large tenders for the supply of coal to tackle the energy crisis. Meanwhile, in a seemingly parallel universe, the EU is focusing on energy sanctions on Russia and wind power projects, which at first glance might make sense until you realize that our alternative energy needs are immediate and the wind projects are 3 to 5 years away from having any impact whatsoever. For my money, the US and India seem to be reacting to real problems in their countries today, whilst the EU continues to live and plan for the future on the misplaced belief that everything is fine today. Maybe they should talk to the ECB and discuss the latest news on Italy. As this briefing is about maize trades, we corrected the disappointing result from April, where there was a single dip in trading. In May, we reverted to circa 16 million, the 16 million level that we had in March. As you'll see from the performance section, we continue our month-on-month improvements, and it remains a healthy 44% higher than what was traded in May 2021. Looking at the Treasury performance, as you'd expect, it lagged behind at 11.57 million because its performance peaks from increased trading in the preceding 76 days. Speaking of which, moving to the average ETR duration date, number of days being 76, it seems that for the second month, the market has finally returned to the credit index average of 75. April was the first month in more than 2 years where we saw the level hit the 70s. And for a moment, or for that moment, I should say, it seems to be staying. And as stated previously, a stable credit index allows for better planning and management by the trade desk. As you all know, the credit index is the ETR average duration or number of days it takes for an ETR to get settled. So the credit index is the cash-to-cash cycle from the day an ETR is issued and purchased in cash and the number of days it takes for the debt to be extinguished or settled and the cash is returned. At 76, it's now up to trade desks to see if they can push that to new lows, perhaps. And with more exposure to trade, finance, and shipping deals, etc., that's a real possibility. At a meeting I had earlier today, the particular settlement time the person was talking about was an average of between 15 and 20 days. So very short. The credit index is our economic indicator that our market, the one we're trading in, is back to normal, and as I said, hopefully it will remain in that 70s zone and remain stable. Moving to the center of the document, this is where we list the 10 largest investable ETR holdings and the top 10 rated holdings. These two lists show what companies or organizations owed the exchange the largest amounts of money as at the 31st of May. And as usual, you can see the HSE remains as an all but constant, along with the Tradius. And there's the continued presence of Nestle and Balfour Beatty and CBRE remaining for its fifth month in a row, with Hansen UK making its debut appearance as one of the three aggregate companies listed in May, being Balfour Beatty, Hansen and Hogan Aggregates. Moving to the top 10 rated investable ETR on the right-hand side, there is the regular appearance of Transport Supplies, and most others apart from Paramount 21 have all but disappeared, only to be replaced by AIB, Populo, Nestle, and so on. These are the highest rated debtors, and apart from Nestle and AIB, as none of them were investment grade or have an investment grade rating on the 31st of May, the list shows a random selection of organizations regardless of the amount of their liability. So it's simply a selection of the most creditworthy. The pie chart below continues to show we have moved back to our more typically well-diversified spread of ETR across the market. Health and Community continues to hover between 16 in February and 19 in April, settling just above 18 in May. Wholesale retail held steady at around 26%, with food and beverage up 1.28%, and manufacturing held firm at almost 9% again, as it did last month. Construction gained 5 points since March, reaching 19.64% in April and coming in at 19.13% for May. As I mentioned before, a significant factor here is the mining and aggregate trades we support for projects in the UK, like the High Speed 2 or HS2 rail link from Birmingham to London. Heading into recession, these infrastructure products are simple and a smart way, are a simple and smart way to prop an economy up. And last month, as I said, Ruby and Andrew were asked to do some light research into this focus on infrastructure projects within the EU bloc. Andrew came back to me last week to confirm that, according to the European Commission website, six countries, including Italy, will undertake 50% of the total number of approved projects, of course, across Europe. And unfortunately, there's no mention of Ireland carrying out any projects at all. In fact, Italy will be the number one country in Europe to spend money on infrastructure projects, with an approved budget of 31 billion. So clearly, they intend to fight off recession by spending their way out of it, if and when it happens. Let's see. Looking to the performance section of the briefing document, you'll see a continuing pattern in the trade for May 21 versus May 2022, where volumes were down, but overall values continued to be up. The briefing shows that volumes are down 40%, give or take, but the values were up 44%. And as explained at previous briefings, this means our ETR are now coming in consistently higher in value than they were a year ago. This makes sense when you consider who our debtors are and the industry sectors that we're focusing on. At an internal meeting last week, we discussed this in more detail. Who would you rather be trading? Large cargo shipments, strong household names like Hansen and AIB, and other conglomerates like Nestlé, or some of the less well-known names that we were trading a year or indeed in a year ago or indeed prior years? I think that question pretty much answers itself. Anyhow, we traded 44 million of those in 2021. Our trade, I should say, was 44 million in 2021. And as you can see, we traded almost another 20 million of that on top of that, or a total of almost 64 million to the end of May 2022. The credit index of 76 is repeated again. And to finish on the performance for May, the largest single trade was a trade finance deal of just over 2.11 million, as with last month. This was another mining trade with aggregates being provided for a UK infrastructure projects. Again, as I explained last month, our originator, the one we went to Hillhead to support last week, requires this funding at this level to complete the delivery of raw aggregate materials to these infrastructure projects throughout the UK. As explained in the investor brochure and also at other briefings, the average value of an ETR is around €2,000, but we have traded ETR where the value has been less than €1, and as you can see here, last month, the largest one was valued at €2.11 million. Finally, let's move to the trend section of the May briefing, where you can see that the investors' yield, or buy price, during the month started at 2.129 and ended down at 2.10. This is only 3 basis points overall, and although the graph exaggerates the move, it could be argued that we're holding steady at this 2.1 position ever since we stopped propping the price up at the beginning of May. As always, and to remind you, with the negative yield of 1% on bank deposits, The investors are getting yields that will be between 3.3 and 3.5% better by buying investable exchange traded receivables than by letting their cash languish unattended in the bank. As you know, this rate changes daily and can be checked on the investable.com website at any time. To finish the briefing, you will see a repeat of the active RSA, our evolving sale agreement, at euro 70.47 million. And that concludes the briefing for May 2022.